Well, welcome everybody. This is Dave. How are you doing?
This is Robin. I have a cold, but otherwise I'm doing okay.
Ah, okay. Excellent. How are things coming in terms of the course?
It's coming along okay. I didn't get a lot done this week, but overall it's going okay.
Is it what you expected?
I think, actually, yes, except I think I haven't, what I need to do is sit down and go through the in-depth, the case studies, just to see how the process is applied in the coaching setting and kind of, I learn pretty well by observing something in practice.
Uh-huh.
So I think that would be one thing I need to do for myself that would help.
That makes sense, and I think, you know, reading some of the case studies, the e-book especially, and really working on your own case study, whether it's yourself or with a client, I think will make it make sense and really bring it into focus. So I'll be eager for us to begin next week to look at one case study each week for the next 3 weeks after that, and Emily begins next week for us. So I think that'll bring it alive even more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to that. That'd be great.
Okay, thanks for the progress note. How is your practice going?
My practice in general?
Right, your coaching practice in specific.
Well, actually right now I have one client. Because of my full-time job, they allow me to fit coaching into it. It's just that during this time, it's a really busy time for our office in general. So I have one client right now. I'm down to one. But I really enjoy coaching, and I think I have 6 more years until I'm eligible to retire from this job. And so I want to get in as much practice as I can. I'd really like to continue that as a second career.
Is it an all-or-nothing position? Can you phase out your job work as you phase in your coaching, or is it all-or-nothing?
I think where I am now, I'm in the federal government, coaching is just now becoming to be really recognized in like human resources work, for example, or leadership development. Unfortunately, I'm in the area of human resources that deals with labor relations and employee relations.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of technical from that standpoint, but I'm able to kind of work in coaching, like working with practitioners and showing them how they can integrate like a coaching conversation with their supervisor client. Things like that, yeah, and with their employees as well.
Uh-huh.
So I'm able to work it that way, but
yeah. That it might be useful to look at how you may want to use what you know and the contacts and all that as you transition to the private sector about how you may interface with people who you work with or whole departments who you come to know, and to see what you might have to offer in that regard.
True.
You know, one application, for example, I do a program that's an internal mentoring program to help like HR departments, organizations, develop their own internal mentoring program to use the tools, methods, principles of mentor coaching to have more effective conversations, better retention, you know, better organization, a whole number of things. And that might be something that, you know, you might be interested in. You have a great deal of expertise in HR already. So just be thinking about the things that you might want to develop.
Oh, very good. Definitely.
Individual, group, as well as organizationally.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, who else has arrived? When's your progress notes? Anyone else here? Well, anything else that you would like to talk about or us to address in terms of things that might be helpful for you?
Not right now.
Okay. Well, I'll go into the material, and we'll have a little bit more time.
Hi, David. It's Emily. Sorry to interrupt
Emily,
you.
Hi. Welcome.
I could hear you, but I've got a new headset, and I can't seem to figure out how to talk through it.
I see. Any wins or progress notes or things that you'd like us to discuss?
I just have been working on I downloaded that whole ebook. I've been reading all that I've been doing over the weekend and trying to. I started my map story, so it seems a little bit easier to write now that I see it. Everyone's in order.
Is the ebook helpful to you?
Yes. Are they all about money stories, though? Are they all new money stories?
No, there are five different sections. Money story is one section.
Okay, so I guess my print only prints out
wellness, them. One is career, one's relationship, one's life, and one's money, as I recall.
Okay. I guess I only got the...
I think that may be the first section, but there are five sections.
Yeah. Okay. Do you hear static, or is that just me that hears static?
I'm not hearing any. What kind
no?
of static do you hear?
It's like the buzz sound the whole time.
Oh.
No. I hear that as well.
Don't hear
yeah.
it. Emily, you're down for presenting your case study next week.
Correct.
As a reminder. So, okay, terrific.
Okay.
Anything else anybody would like to talk about or challenges with clients or anything about the material before we move into the material? Okay, well, we're looking at Module 5 now at advancing the plot. With this session, I want to bring together some of what we've been discussing about guiding change and facilitating growth. And then beginning next session, we're going to talk about niche applications. So life stories change in three ways, basically. When existing solutions no longer work, when situations change, or when possibilities require new approaches. Sometimes you just come to the end of a story cycle and recognize you don't exactly have a new one waiting to step into. Was there a question? There's some background noise in we need to manage. If there's any background noise at all, if you would mute so I can keep an open line. So how do you make sense of new information that doesn't fit into an existing framework? Usually people ignore it until they no longer can. Now, as alchemists, we help people see possibility to engage a transformative process. So I want to expand and look at advancing the plot of a story. I want to first look at some different types of empathy, because this is something that we use as a primary tool. Empathy is a listening perspective inside the experience of another. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, and communicates. In other words, to know as much as possible their subjective reality and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. So as we talk about how we read and respond to others' experiences, I want to consider three forms of empathy and the upside and downside of each. One is cognitive empathy, to know the perspective of another person, what that person might be thinking, for example. This can help in negotiation. It can help find a way to motivate people, for example, and in coaching. A study at the University of Birmingham found that managers who were good at taking another's perspective, cognitive empathy, were able to help workers better achieve and sustain their best efforts. Now, the downside with only cognitive empathy, it can result in cold calculations. understanding another's point of view without taking emotions into account, a kind of informed detachment. A second is emotional empathy. When you can sense what other people experience as though their emotions were contagious. This emotional contagion occurs largely because of mirror neurons in the brain, a complex set of neural response patterns that fire when we sense another's emotional state. In other words, we sense the echo of another's experience in our own minds and bodies. We resonate with that. This emotional empathy attunes us to another person's emotional world. And this is immensely valuable in coaching. Now, the downside with emotional empathy, the coach may have some difficulty managing his or her own emotions if they're powerful or if they're distressing enough. And you also have to protect yourself from depletion, from psychological exhaustion, especially if you're a feeler. Even more so if you're an intuitive empath. Now, Emily, I know you've heard me recommend this before. I would recommend that you Google the term intuitive empath and to look at one of the first two or three articles just to read really about yourself, because my bet is that each of us are intuitive empaths. But particularly notice the segment of the article that you look at about what you need to do to protect yourself if you're an intuitive empath, especially from the toxic presence of others or from groups, and how and the value of being aware of this to protect yourself to not get depleted. Here's an example. My own experience during Hurricane Katrina, we witnessed high-level leaders being curiously detached despite abundant evidence that they needed to take action. I saw on television the suffering and misery that people in New Orleans experienced. My own response, since I did some of my medical training in New Orleans, was, I know those people. I treated some of them. That guy wading through the water carrying his baby, I could have delivered him when he was born. Now, so that's the downside, to get way over-involved. Too little involvement, on the other hand, is indifferent. The balance is informed caring that doesn't get in the way of the client having all of his or her experience themselves and working with it. So empathy is not an end in itself. It's a means to a better end. And as a footnote here, and sort of related, when someone carefully crafts a speech or tells a story, the art is to allow the emotional response to reside in the listener or the reader. Rather than expressing yourself or telling someone how they should respond, you facilitate the other person to have his or her own experience. We can learn from the poets who give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves. And third, compassionate empathy. The resonance with another, the experience and knowledge that we are all connected. An example of a balance, staying cool in the crisis and sometimes allowing ourselves to regulate the coolness in order to get hot enough to help. But a judgment call in compassionate empathy to recognize where you can and where you can't be effective in doing something. So two caveats of empathy. If you move into abstraction, it's less real. There's a drop-off of empathy as you move further away from the real experience of people. For example, someone may feel more empathy for a puppy with a hurt paw than for a person without health insurance. The person without health insurance can appear as a statistic, one among 51 million others. And listen for if a client moves into abstraction or into a vague retreat from something, because it usually means that they're moving away from some powerful emotion that they don't want to experience. And a second application. A neuroscience study published in Science magazine shows that when something bad happens to someone we envy, the result is that we feel good. The pleasure we derive from their humiliation was shown by University of Cambridge fMRI scans to activate the region of the brain that responds to conflict and social rejection. And we talked about this before as we were looking at Money Story. The more we envy someone, the greater the pleasure in their downfall. So let's look at mind maps, which are really the brain's story. The brain connections, or mind maps, influence the reality that we see. The mind map is the brain's story. A paradigm, which is roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or a frame of reference, simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. Now, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning, and strategy can make a significant difference. Each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, and we just assume that we see things the way they are. These paradigms, the way we see things, then determine how we structure meaning and how we think and behave, even how and whether we notice something or not, whether our radar is coded for it or not. We originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. The beliefs then confirm our models of the world. They become predictors. They become, without even having to consciously decide, a way of being affected. A map reduces the size and complexity of a territory. With this understanding, we can be effective in taking action. Rather than each situation being overwhelming or chaotic or a new experience, our attention shifts to this organizing frame of reference, the mind map. We help a client choose the most effective mind map. We relate it to something we know, which immediately suggests option action. A danger is that we place the new into the container of the old, which could prevent new learning. And what we've come to know in very recent time in neuroscience is this is exactly the way the brain works. When there's a cue for a new stimulus or situation, the brain boots up a mind map that is designed to process information for that particular stimulus. A new stimulus, the brain boots up another mind map. That's why we have to work to create the continuity in this ongoing series of mind maps and create a story that's superordinate that helps us understand and give meaning to these series of mind maps so that we have a continuity of our lives. A mind map simply allows us not to have to discover again each time what something means or its purpose or how to deal with it. It's like going the same way to work each day, same route, so you don't have to think about it and you can think about other things and read an audiobook. You don't have to relearn the route every time. Beliefs become effective ways to use previous experiences as a map to navigate. UCLA research professor Marilyn Kurowski found that 97% of kindergartners think out of the box, while only 3% of people by age 30 do. Kindergartners don't plan ways to think out of the box. They've simply not constructed a box yet. The box is a personal construction, a belief system that is actively created both consciously and unconsciously to shape both perception and processing. At times, a way to think outside the box is to simply suspend judgment and approach something with a beginner's mind. It opens the door to possibility. One of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. Having this ability, we can learn from both our own experiences and from those of others. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well, which ones do and which ones don't. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps that are in conflict. So the work of coaching, then, in this regard, involves two levels. One, a macroscopic level, selecting the mental map that is most productive for a given task, or developing a meta map. You know, a simple example is a client is reacting to an emotional charged event, and in a rumination about a negative thought loop, a simple intervention could be, what is the age of that conversation? And the client may immediately recognize, that's a mid-adolescent. I'm 15 when I'm doing that. So we help the client recognize there was a state change, and that map, that mindset, is not one that is currently designed or matched for this present situation. So the first order of business is always state before story or strategy, to see if the state of mind is matching the situation, because state always determines the meaning that we attach to something, and the meaning we attach determines our behavior. So we want to be sure that someone is present and centered, and therefore going to use a mind map that is present and tailored for the immediate situation. Another example. To correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as validation of moving ahead beyond the comfort zone, rather than in an old model where anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, so that we may help someone use a current paradigm and help them understand that the anxiety or uncertainty or trepidation is simply their experience of this being a new experience, something that they haven't done before, and that is a sign, a signal of being in new territory, a validation that they're moving ahead, rather than a signal that may be misread as, well, this anxiety is telling me that my gut's telling me this isn't the right thing, or my intuition says this is wrong, or just simply of immediate danger and reverting back to a different time and a different way of responding. Secondly, at a microscopic level, an awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one, the choice architecture. Here's a simple example. If you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. If you label feeling bad saying no to someone, if you feel bad by saying no to somebody, and then label that feeling as guilt, you're going to use a really different map than if you say no and experience some trepidation or anxiety about it, but yet if you see it as setting an appropriate boundary where no means no, and you're taking care of yourself. So if you read it as guilt, you're off on a different trajectory than recognizing it's uncomfortable, but no means no, and you're taking care of yourself, even though it may be new or different. Here's an example of another conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. His daughter said, well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and wishes. He said, well, that's none of your business. So remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality at a consensual level. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories and need to take ownership of those stories in order to assess what needs to change or be enhanced or simply be ignored. So one way to do this first is we identify the particular patterns we use, the attachment patterns or behavior patterns. Then we look at the specific ways that we maintain these beliefs. Because just as you have to know the steps in order to dance, you have to know the beliefs that construct the story. And the beliefs are not always conscious. They may be part of that shadow story. And remember, beliefs drive behaviors. Beliefs determine the experiences and results of what we do. And people always make their beliefs come true. If you believe no one will love you, you're going to interpret behavior and perceive responses in exactly that way and act so that you won't be lovable or that you may block intimacy. Then you act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Beliefs are directives to your mind to make something happen in your life. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. And remember, if you want to know what someone's fundamental belief is, you can simply say, "Yeah, but how do you really know that?" One way to determine your core beliefs is to assess the results you're getting in your life. Outcome is measured by results, not by intention, not by the story you want to have happen. So, examine the results in each of these different domains, these storylines of your life. Financial, career, relationship, personal, wellness. Consider that if somebody's getting a better result, they may have a different or better or more empowering belief. With the same belief, you're going to continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. The most common source of resistance is to continue to hold an old belief and expect new results. So any thoughts or questions at this point? Anything that's coming up that you'd like to expand or elaborate a little bit more? Okay, well, I'll press on. I want to revisit the notion of comfort zone. Remember, a comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once it's established, resist change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it or even when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone, meaning really a zone of familiarity, is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. This is the allure of it. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. A comfort zone can be a behavior pattern, such as self-effacing jokes, or a state of mind, such as responding angrily to certain situations. It can be a repeated role you play in a relationship, or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make. A comfort zone may manifest in certain patterns, storylines, or recurring characters. Working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating crises, all can be comfort zones. For example, someone can be an underdog and succeed against all odds. This can become a comfort zone of behavior in which the same pattern is repeated over and over, faster and faster perhaps, so that the escalating success is the repeated comfort zone. Now, here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend, give away, or in some way divest themselves of their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In fact, just over 80% of the lottery winners of over $3 million in the United States file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. Now, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. And in the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to stay in it. The choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone. But remember, a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. So, one option, break out of your comfort zone. Your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. If people get more successful, they feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. If the results go outside their self-image, it cues an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's one example I heard Jack Canfield tell about his stepdad. Jack's stepdad was a regional manager for NCR. This was the late 70s, early 80s. He noticed that each of his salespeople had a particular self-image of themselves as a salesperson. They saw themselves as a $2,000 a month salesperson or a $3,000 a month salesperson. If a salesperson's self-image was that he earned $3,000 a month in commissions, when he got to that figure each month, he would kind of tail off or slack off to the next month. But if it were close to the end of the month and he only earned, say, $1,250 or $1,500, he would work 16-hour days, weekends, and beat the bushes till he got to $3,000. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain because your brain has a mind of its own. Now, let's talk about thought loops for a moment. Remember we talked about how emotion can seize and hold hostage your logical thinking left brain, emotion originating and being processed in the right brain. Now, a thought loop is mentally replaying the same thoughts and reviewing the same scenarios again and again. You can't find an exit. You can't think or logic your way out of it. A thought loop drains energy and leads to no new situation. It can look like focusing, but it's really obsessing. Think of a time when you got into a thought loop, maybe an argument with a partner, a disappointing review, upsetting information about your child. Thought loops are being marooned in your left brain. Common precipitants, hurt, helplessness, disappointment. And the thought loop becomes a repetition of things like, well, if I'd only done this, or this is what I should have said. Part of the thought loop includes picking things in the environment that fit into that thought cycle. You choose the data that confirm your belief. In other words, state comes first. That determines the mindset, the software that we use. That will then determine what to choose and how it's processed once chosen. Remember, for example, the Y2K scare, the repeated concerns and anticipation of disaster. People were even storing extra food, water supplies in anticipation of worldwide computer failures. Mark Twain put this very simply. He said, "I've lived a long life and I've had many troubles. A few of them actually even happened." So I want to illustrate very simply here how the roadmap process can be applied to thought loops. So let's take the example of worry, of rumination about something. You just can't get out of your mind. First, recognize that you're in a thought loop of worry. Now, some worry about the future is natural, but for some people, worry is a constant, unwelcome state of mind. Chronic worriers seek a control that's elusive. Excess worry depletes the immune system and undermines the ability to react to stress. Worry can involve magical thinking. Worriers may believe that overthinking a potentially negative event actually keeps it from happening. Next step, observe the triggers that initiate a thought loop of worry. Common triggers include appearance, money, sex, body image, career, aging. Next step, assess the best response. Objectify and reality check perception, facts, and decision. Get other points of view, especially those you trust. Identify productive and unproductive worry. Next step, determine the next best action. Identify what you can and can't be effective in doing. In order to let go of what you can't bring about, to put all of your energy into what you can determine. You may need to self-correct as you move ahead, and moving ahead will create its own momentum and its own exit from the negative thought loop of worry. Next step, map changes. Make an appointment for your worries to contain them to a circumscribed period of time. Map changes by developing a plan to manage the situations that precipitate the worry and the trigger for it, and to convert or reframe triggers into cues for a new story. Reframe your worry to look at positive implications and especially incorporate what you should be grateful for. Next step, author new experiences. Put worries in perspective. Consider the fate of your past worries to see which ones have worked. Consider how worry can benefit performance and encourage action. A simple example includes smokers worried about the risk of smoking who convince themselves to quit. Stay present. Since worry is a state of mind, rather than continuing to focus on the content of the specific worry, focus on being present, grounded, centered, relaxed. Create a plan. The antithesis of worry is not to stop worrying, but to make a plan and stick to it. Remember what neuroscience teaches us. When you focus on something, you align your thought field of energy to etch it further in your brain. And finally, program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. Incorporate the desired changes into your evolving identity of your true self. I want to talk a little bit about choice architecture applied here. An example. A study at a local car wash that ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card, and when they filled their card with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But they were given a head start, and that when they received their cards, 2 stamps had already been added. So, basically, the goal was the same for both sets of customers, requiring the purchase of 8 car washes to get a reward. Shouldn't make any difference. But the psychology, and therefore the motivation, was really different. For those who had a head start with the 2 stamps, they were already in their mind 20% of the way. Hear the mindset here. I'm already 20% of the way, rather than starting from scratch. So, several months later, the results were in. 19% of the 8 stamp customers earned a free car wash. 34% of the Head Start group earned a free wash, those who had 2 already stamped. So, almost twice the difference. And this group, the Head Start group with 2 stamps, earned their free car wash faster, meaning they were ready to start over and spend money sooner by a factor of 2. So in other words, the Head Start group, there was 4 times difference of the two in terms of response just on the basis of having the first two stamped. What does this tell us now? People are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey than to be just beginning even a shorter one. To help someone motivate action would be to frame the task to help them feel that they're closer to the finish line. An example of this. With every client, from time to time, I will want to take a step back and look at where that client is now, where that client began, and where that client wants to go, and to look at where we are in this process. Inevitably, it's a way to create an internal model for self-validation, to look at the significant progress that a client has made, to really own that, validate it, look for ways to mark it and measure it so that ultimately they'll do it on their own. And it's a kind of a congratulations to look at how much has been done. And I'll use different markers with the client. For example, earlier today I mentioned to a client, you know, I can tell how much work you've done in even less than 2 months because a month ago, I could not have said this in this way to you. I feel now that you have the strength and the working alliance that I can say everything I need to you and that you're going to take it in a meaningful way and work with it. So I don't have to be careful. And she acknowledged, I've been told all my life that people have had to be careful with me. Now I understand. So let's talk about framing something. The framework also is something to consider. How you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind, and your mind can change your brain. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or situation. And the structure of meaning is an inside job. Your response, your perception of an experience, and the meaning that you attribute to it is the bridge between an external event and an internal state. Each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there till you create it. An original experiment done by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky had subjects spin a wheel that supposedly would stop at random numbers between 1 and 100. Then they were asked what percent of African countries belong to the United Nations. For one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop on 10. For the second group, it was preset to stop on 65. The first group guessed that 25% of African nations belonged to the United Nations. The second group guessed 45%. And that's called priming, to have an anchor of what sets a frame in motion and creates a mindset. The subjects insisted that the number on the wheel had no relation to the correct answer to the question, yet the number the wheel stopped on had profound influence on their responses. So even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which can then influence decisions. The primary reasons, for example, that people give for not participating in retirement plans include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, because of other pressing financial demands. The way you frame a question can make a great deal of difference. Here's an example of that effect. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plans, the employee has to opt out to not participate. In other words, to actively make a decision, a choice that says, I will not save for my future. Now, another frame, when it's automatic that somebody's in to start with, of course it's 100% by definition, then if they choose to opt out, it levels out to 86 to 94%. When companies where it isn't automatic and somebody has to choose to opt in, 20% participate, over a four-fold difference in participation in retirement savings just on the way it's framed. here's another example of how people are sensitive to things that shouldn't matter, but it's good to know what does matter. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to. In other words, they decide to opt out. The rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries have a form where if someone does donate their organs, they have to opt in to check the box to donate. The rate of donation, 18%. Again, over a four-fold difference, just in the way something's framed. To discern meaning, we have to have a context to surround it. The frame can even determine a state of mind. And think about how we help clients reframe. Somebody has a setback or a disappointment or a crisis. Rather than continuing to focus on the upsetting issue and the negative energy, we may resonate empathically to join that individual in creating a common ground, and then can collaborate to reframe the situation by, for example, asking, let's look at the opportunity here. What can this teach us? In other words, problem to possibility. And when someone completes their list of options or runs out of possibilities, we may even nudge, what else? The reticular activating system is at the base of our brains and decides what is allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Focus on your feet. Wiggle your toes. Move your feet back and forth on the floor. Be very aware of what your feet are feeling like, the kind of information that you're getting through your feet. Now, think about how that information, that feedback, has always been coming in through your reticular activating system, but you just particularly at that moment decided to focus on it so you were aware of it. And remember, we become aware of what we determine is part of our story. You pay attention to whatever fits your story, the framework you use. For example, part of your story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you and you don't believe it, it's not going to register, or it'll be disavowed with an internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? So how do you reframe or reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve? Natural filters include beliefs, self-image, and goals. So here's a simple three-step combination to reframe your comfort zone. One, visualization. You create powerful and stimulating internal images. Visualization reprograms the reticular activating system by programming awareness of what to focus on. Two, affirmations. The positive validation of doing and being what you want. The story that frames the visualization. And finally, the third thing, change your behavior. You can't just add something new onto an already existing system. You have to interrupt the pattern, change the behavior, and do something that you have decided is a strategic next best action. New behavior and new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, these pathways become more deeply etched. When well-grooved, it becomes a habit, an automatic behavior, the default mode. Your future self lives in your present mind. If clearly visualized, it's simply a matter of actualizing that vision. I want to focus on thoughts, but I want to focus on focus. But I want to pause for a minute to see, before we go into a final segment here, are there any thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to talk about or even clarify?
I had a few questions with Emily.
Please, go ahead.
Well, What was the last thing that you said, new experience, new change creates new behavior, or was it new experience, new behavior creates new change? I got that backwards.
If I'm answering your question right, there's a three-step combination to reframe your comfort zone, visualization, affirmation, and change the behavior.
Okay.
Is that what you asked?
Well, you said specifically a certain thing. You said new experience creates new change or something creates new behavior. I was just trying to write the words.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Would you speak up a little bit more and ask that question again?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time hearing you the whole time, too. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can. Better.
Never mind that question. I guess I...
Well, see if this is an answer to what I think you asked. I talked about when something becomes well-grooved, it becomes a habit and automatic as a default mode, and that your future self lives in your present mind. And when you clearly visualize something, it then is a matter only of actualizing that vision, because you create a visualization, which is a future memory. When you repeat that, you're rewiring your brain, and then it's a matter of strategically backing into it. Does that address what you were asking?
Yes, it does.
I'm going to send around a copy. I just got it back, a revision. I'm going to send around a copy of Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual. And it's an e-book, and one of the chapters is about the old art, new science of visualization. It has some specific behavioral ways to go about creating a vision, and specific ways also of creating affirmations, which are the story that will support the visualization. So I'll send that book around within the next 24 hours.
Okay.
And look especially at that chapter on visualization. It will explain a lot more that I just haven't really taken the time to go into detail here. That was another part of your question.
Oh yeah, I just had a question about the reframe. So for an example, you said reframe. I was talking to my child the other day, and we were just talking about his feelings, and he all of a sudden said something about, I hate my life, I hate having two houses, I hate divorce. And I try to say, well, there's something positive in it. Try to reframe the session, like just our talk. And he said, there's nothing good in it for me. I hate divorce sucks. And I didn't know how to reframe the session. Like, what do you say when your kid says that to you?
Well, that's a tough call. First, before strategy and story, I would recommend always state of mind, and how to address the state of mind here first would be to say, you know, I understand how upsetting and how stressful it's been to go through the divorce. So whatever would be specific for that child in that situation, your first response is an empathic resonance to create a common ground together so that you are both together at the same place. You have to be where that person is before you can go someplace new together. So you have to get where they are first. Then to go to someplace new would be to ask your question about how do you reframe that. So you might look at, can you see any possibility of a benefit or something that you can learn or that we can learn to help us get through something better, or to ask something that you have some indication might be a way to look at possibility rather than problem. Because what you want to do, rather than go down that same neural pathway of the problem, once you've created a common ground together with that empathic resonance, you want to look at how do you ignite or how do you activate new potential in someone's brain by looking at possibility rather than problem. A problem goes down the same pathway, it edges it even further, which is, I mentioned, why people get stuck in therapy often. But to look at possibility of what can we learn? What's the one thing that you've learned from divorce? Yeah, well, I don't think I've learned anything. I'll bet one thing is that it's something that you will not want to go through when you get married.
Yeah, that's what I said. You could treat your partner with respect, yeah.
Say it again?
Yeah, that's what I tried talking to him. I was like, maybe you can help your friend, or you can learn to treat your partner one day with more, you know, respect so this doesn't happen.
And, he just looked at me like from the person rather than telling. Because
telling them, yeah.
Information or priming the pump. You know, try to elicit from the person.
Okay,
and go with where they are and what they're already thinking and feeling so that you can go someplace new together. So, yeah, that's, you know, it's a challenge, especially when there's a whole lot of emotional charge overarching the whole process still and when you're still in the middle of it.
Right.
It's a real challenge. Anybody else have any suggestions? Anything that you do or have done or have heard of doing that has worked?
This is Robin. I just wanted to say it really helped to just be reminded that you always go to the state of mind first, and that empathetic acknowledgement of where that person is. That was very, very helpful. That's something I think, and thank you, Emily, for bringing that up, because that is now cemented in my head, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
I learned that in the most succinct way some time ago. I was working with a woman executive in psychoanalysis, and she was lying on the couch, and we were talking, and I offered an interpretation of something that I thought would be particularly useful to her, and it was immediately met with silence. And she actually got up leaned on one elbow, looked back at me and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." And of course she was right, but that was the most succinct, elegant way I've ever heard it put, exactly what we're discussing now. You've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you. And that's exactly what we're talking about with every client, every time, every child. We have to be with them before we have any hope of them going someplace new with us. And being with them needs to be that empathic resonance. And then looking at things empathically from their vantage point. Keeping one foot in your shoe, one foot in the client's shoe. I had I collaborated earlier and had a point of difference with Gloria Steinem. When she was doing some of her work, and she put it in this way, that you have to get in someone else's shoes in order to understand where they are. And the subtle yet distinct difference is when you put one foot in someone's shoe, you're appreciating their position, but you're not diminishing or abandoning your own position, because you have to have that leverage and that objectivity that you retain in order to collaborate to move someplace new. Because if you jump in and put both feet in somebody's shoes, then it's like, well, I can't get there from here. It's like I feel overwhelmed too. So it's a subtle but yet important distinction about really collaborating with somebody and helping someone to get to a better place. From where they are. They can only begin with where they are, not with where you are.
Thank you. I have one more question about the thought loop
yes.
on the assess the best response.
Uh-huh.
Can you get an example of what assess the best response means?
Well, that is predicated on getting grounded and centered. So, when somebody is in a negative thought loop, they're in an altered state of mind. So the key is to understand the cue and the trigger. Remember that four-column approach?
Yeah.
To look at the emotional cue or trigger, and then the immediate reactive response, the behavior, so that the first step in recognizing that, and recognizing it, owning it, assessing it, first step is not to deal with any of the content, but to get present and to get grounded and centered, then to look at what is an ideal response. It's going to look different from the position of being grounded and centered and not caught up in the content of that old state of mind, because you're looking at old material and a familiar state of mind from a new place. So it's going to look different from that new place, and you make a current assessment about what's in your best interest at this moment once you're no longer in that negative thought loop. If it's somebody has said something that has caused you to get derailed, then you can look at that again from a current position. You know, is it true? Is that information I can use? How do I best respond to that person? Is it better to not respond at all? What's the sound of one hand clapping? To not engage? Or what will be in my best interest? So it's an assessment.
Assess would be what's in your best interest kind of idea.
From a present state of mind, after you've gotten into a grounded and centered position. That's always the first step. State is always first. Then story and strategy. So that's the two-step process. Get in the right state. That's the third column. And then what's the ideal response? That's the fourth column. So the two-step process. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's a principle that I think will apply consistently. So those are really good questions and good scenarios or situations, because I think you're going to find that they're going to be ubiquitous, because somebody is going to respond with some content of an altered state and think that's the problem. You know, the issue is, you know, somebody, a client this morning said, you know, I feel like I just don't have what it takes. And I ask, what's the age of that conversation? Said, well, I know I'm already in an altered state. I know that that's a response to my ex-husband. So the issue here is to recognize all the content of an altered state. It's not to feel your feelings. This is not a time or a situation where feeling your feelings is going to do anything good. It will just distract you from what you really need to do, which is get grounded and centered and look at what an ideal response is from a present situation, from a state of mind, a mindset that is appropriate for the situation, to take care of yourself now rather than succumb in an old way to an abusive exchange with an ex-husband.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts or questions?
I would just had an interesting story. Just you were talking about the car wash, the little car wash stamp. And it's funny because I've been doing a star chart with my twins who are 9 years old. And one of them, this didn't work before, but my therapist said, you got to really follow through and give them reward. So finally they've been getting this reward, and they're twins. So the boy, he's been making me dinner and doing the dishes and stuff, getting a reward, and he's really going for it. Well, apparently I didn't give my daughter a star when she thought she deserved one, so she got mad, ripped up her star chart, and said she quits, and I don't do star charts anymore. But he is still going with the mindset. Like, so for him, it's really working. So it's funny that that was kind of the same story with a car wash.
That's interesting. I'll bet you can find a way to rectify it because with your daughter, because, you know, it's not the empathic failure or the rupture that we have with our children that is most meaningful. It's how we repair that. How we repair that empathic rupture is a model that will be used now and going forward with our children. And that's what will contribute to self-regulation, is how we address and repair a situation to make it better, and what can be learned from it, rather than just abandoning it. And that means the fit worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to work in the real world. You don't just have it unless you're Donald Trump.
You just
have a fit and move on, and it works. But if it works,
right,
as a kid, you're in trouble.
Exactly.
Because it's not going to work in the real world. Thanks for the example. Let me finish with just one aspect here. I want to talk about focus and revisit that. Where you have direct impact, what you can determine, where you can be effective, is your circle of influence. When somebody cuts you off on the freeway, is getting angry going to inoculate you to the next occurrence? Will getting upset in a traffic jam speed up traffic? These are your circle of concern. All the things that you can't determine, which usually ends at the level of your skin, everything from the ozone level to how your partner responds, things that you can't be immediately effective in doing. So it's important to discern between these two, to look at what you can determine, your circle of influence, and what you can't, your circle of concern, so that you can put all of your energy into what you can determine and let go of what you can't determine anyhow, rather than working in a fruitless way to try to make it work. So engaging a negative or fear-based belief in order to counter it will create what you most want to avoid. The more you keep running away from something, the more you engage it. Positive affirmations need to be based on positive beliefs that are believable. Every day, several times a day, we say yes or no to things in our lives. The results we get in our lives are the result of our focus. If we automatically and unconsciously focus on what we don't want, we polarized ourselves to become a magnet for it and direct ourselves toward it. Without being consciously aware, perhaps, you can focus on something you don't want and bring it about. If a belief that certain relationships can be painful and you have to watch out for certain people and avoid them, then you focus your mind on precisely that, dead relationships and people who can hurt you. This focus draws precisely about you what you don't want and even attracts you to it. When these people appear in your life, you're unconsciously drawn to them, though consciously repelled by them. This ultimate paradox is why people keep having the same relationship with different people, because it's an attachment pattern that's embedded in our minds and our brains from very early on. And this paradox occurs in every aspect of life. What you don't want, you ironically make happen. Focusing on not making mistakes creates mistakes. Focusing on not being late creates lateness. Focusing on not wanting to be financially insolvent creates scarcity. Focusing on not smoking probably makes you want to smoke. Your mind is an energy field and responds to focus. Whether the focus is negative or positive, the response is to the focus. Your mind precisely and effectively creates what you focus on. Brain research shows that focusing on problems or negative behavior reinforces those problems and behaviors. Additionally, the harder you push people to change, the harder they're going to push back. So the best mentor coaching strategies focus on the present and the future, possibilities and solutions rather than problems. This stimulates the development of new neural pathways in the brain and learning new thinking patterns. The most important principle is to focus on what you do want rather than what you don't want. And secondly, become conscious and aware so that you can direct this power of focus to the specific outcomes that you want. So you can even design an exercise to do it. Discover all the things that you focus on that you don't want. Make a list of those things so that you can cue your radar to be aware of them as soon as you begin to light on them. Kind of a to-don't list. instead of a to-do list. Be very specific also about what you do want, a to-do list. Be certain that what you want and focus on is not just what you don't want in disguise. Like an example is, I want a relationship in which I'm treated well and regarded positively. This focuses on the expectation of not being treated well and having to reverse it. Or saying, I want a reliable car, occurs because of some focus on the idea the car may break down and need repairs. The desire to avoid something is usually the result of negative emotional experiences with what you want to avoid. And trying to avoid those things, paradoxically, creates them. So, work on these lists over time so you'll immediately be aware of the to-don't and the to-do list. And keep being aware and working on them. Practice changing your focus to what you want and what's positive. And reframing, you know, why can't I do this? Why does this keep happening to me? To what's the possibility here? Or how can I figure out a way? So, any other, no, we only have a couple of minutes, but any other thoughts or questions that, or anything else you'd like to talk about that may be helpful?
Wait, did you say you want to make a list on things to focus on that you don't want, and also a list of things to focus on that you do want? And it's both.
Yes.
It's good to do both.
It is, and just the to-don't list is just to really put down and be aware of what you tend to focus on or ruminate about, so that immediately when you do it, you'll be aware, so that you can stop that and move to the to-do list, to something that you want. Kind of like the four-column approach, to be immediately aware of the emotional cues or triggers and the behavioral response, so that you cue your radar to be aware of it immediately rather than lingering and trying to figure out all the content of that state that's in that second column. You immediately become aware of the process so that you can address it at the level of process to get present, to move to column three instead of getting stuck in column two. So same principle about cueing your radar to be aware earlier and better.
Okay, that sounds good.
Other thoughts or comments? Well, thank you all very much, and we'll pick up right here next time. I'll be eager to hear what your applications are, and we'll begin next time after a very brief discussion with Emily's case presentation. So
thanks very much,
and have a great rest of the week. Look forward
to
seeing
you next time.
Thank you.
Okay.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.